From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Some Scottish Loch Hauntings. Loch Lomond was haunted for many years by a Kelpie that played tricks, sometimes harmful, on people who visited the lake alone at night. Kelpies also haunted Lochs Gleish and Awe. A phantom lake populated by little women phantoms used to appear from time to time in the highlands. Loch Nigdal was haunted at one time by a phantom woman in a green silk dress who was erroneously termed a banshee. Hugh Miller, in his Scenes and Legends of the North of Scotland, relates the story of a Bin Nigh, or the Phantom Wishing Woman, that haunted Loch Slyn. In the autumn of 1742, the pretty daughter of the widow of a farmer was returning home one Sunday morning along a path on the southern bank of Loch Slyn, where the parish of Tarbat bordered on that of Ferne. She had turned a projecting angle of the bank when she saw, not 10 yards away, what seemed to be a tall, lovely female standing in the water immediately beyond the line of reeds and rushes that fringed the shore, engaged apparently in knocking clothes on a stone with a sort of bludgeon used in the north of Scotland for that purpose. There was something so unearthly and eerie about the woman that the farmer's daughter felt sure she was the Bin Nigh, who was known to haunt the lake. Although terrified, she was compelled to keep looking at the phantom, who seemed to ply her work with a malignant pleasure. After a minute or two, she threw down the bludgeon and pointed to a number of smocks and shirts that were covered with blood. This horrified the girl to such a degree that she tore herself away from the lake and ran all the way home. When she arrived there, she collapsed, and it was some time before she recovered. Shortly after noon, she went for a walk with her mother, and when they were near the old Abbey of Ferne, there was a tremendous crash, accompanied by a terrific cry. A dense cloud of dust enveloped the ancient building, and when it had cleared away, the frightened mother and daughter saw that the ponderous roof of the abbey had collapsed. As soon as they had recovered in a measure from the shock of the noise and sight, they hastened to the abbey to see if they could be of any aid. As they approached the building, they met two young women covered with blood, who were running shrieking along the road, and shortly afterwards an old man, so badly injured that he could hardly walk. He told them not to stop and try to help him, but to go as quickly as possible to the assistance of those people who were worse injured than himself. They did as he bid and ran to the churchyard. A fearful scene met their eyes. 2/3 of the abbey roof had fallen, and nearly half the people who had been attending service inside the building were buried in the ruins. Men, covered with blood and dust and yelling like maniacs, were tearing up the stones and slates that were heaped over their wives and children. All the sufferers were carried out one by one and laid on the flat tombstones of the abbey churchyard. The farmer's widow busied herself in staunching their wounds and restoring their animation. A young man came staggering from the ruins, his face bleeding, carrying the mutilated dead body of his father. It was a cousin of the farmer's daughter. 36 people had been killed, and many so badly injured that they never recovered. The Bin Nigh was never seen knocking and washing in Loch Slyn, except before some dire calamity in the neighborhood. Hugh Miller, in the same book, writes about another loch haunting in northern Scotland. About the middle or latter part of the 18th century, a young man bought a piece of ground in the parish of Tarbat, on which stood the ruins of a cottage. The The last occupants of the cottage had been an old married couple who were miserably poor and had eked out a wretched existence. The young man rebuilt the cottage and removed to it with his wife. Close to the cottage was a little muddy lake, which almost dried up in the summer. It bore such an eerie reputation that few people cared to linger near it after dark. The young married couple, having but recently come to the neighborhood, were unaware of this, but the first night they were in the cottage, they saw weird lights hovering about the lake and heard ghastly cries and other harrowing sounds coming from it. The third evening, they were disturbed by strange noises in the cottage, and the door of their bedroom was suddenly opened and a figure wrapped in a gray plaid entered the room. The young man leaped out of bed and tried to grapple with the intruder, but his arms encountered nothing solid. "Who are you?" he asked. "The unhappy ghost of the peddler who was murdered 60 years ago and his body thrown into the lake," the specter replied. "I have come to tell you that the murderer no longer lives, and in 2 short hours, the permitted time of my wanderings on earth shall be over. For had I escaped the cruel knife, I would have died in my bed, a gray-haired old man." The specter had hardly finished speaking when it vanished. From that night onward, the cottage and the lake ceased to be haunted. The young man informed the local authorities what had happened. With the result, the lake was drained and the skeleton of a man was found buried in the mud and weeds. It was believed to be the skeleton of the peddler who had disappeared very mysteriously from the neighborhood many years previously. The End of the Ravine. There are two versions of the story of the haunting at the end of the wall. One was published in one of my very early books entitled Haunted Highways and Byways, and the other, which differs considerably from it, I came across quite recently. Both are about James Curry of Montrose. I never met Curry. He was a young man when I was a boy and lived in the days of horse-drawn vehicles and early bicycles. He was spending his annual summer holiday in a remote part of the Scottish Highlands. He was a keen fisherman and set out one evening from his hotel to find a tarn, which he had been told was full of trout. He was accompanied by his dog, Blob. The route he took led him across a wild and lonely moor, surrounded on all sides by gaunt mountains. Leaving the moor in his rear, he entered a narrow, gloomy ravine, at the end of which he could see the tarn gleaming in the distance. The air felt unpleasantly chilly. The silence was depressing. It did not seem natural. Nothing, not the cry of a bird or the slightest sound, disturbed it. There was a sense of deadness in the atmosphere and of an absence of all life. Curry was not superstitious. He did not believe in ghosts, or thought that he did not. Yet, for probably the first time in his life, he felt strangely uneasy. There seemed to be a tenseness and a sense of general expectation present all around him. Blob kept very close to him. He was rather more than halfway through the ravine when a sudden sensation of intense dread came over him, and he halted. He dared not advance another yard. The wall of one side of the ravine ended in a lofty, keen-edged rock, and he felt instinctively that concealed behind it and waiting for him was some awful thing that had come out of the tarn. He blamed himself for being so silly and fanciful and tried to overcome his fear, but it persisted. Blob was seemingly afraid of something, too, for he crouched on the ground, even closer than before to Curry, and whined pitifully. Curry stuck it out as long as he could, and then, feeling thoroughly ashamed of himself, he returned to his hotel. He mentioned his experience in the ravine to the landlord of his hotel and asked him if he could think of any explanation for his sudden feeling of dread. "The tarn is rumored to be haunted," the landlord said, "and several people have told me that when they were in the ravine they felt much the same as you did." There was a London cockney in the room, and he laughed and said, "I thought you Scots were far too hardy to be afraid of ghosts. I don't believe there are such things." His laugh nettled Curry. "I'm going there again," he said. "In the daytime, of course," the Londoner sneered, "and when the sun is shining brightly. Night is a time for ghosts. I bet you dare not go then." "How much will you bet?" Curry asked. "A quid," the Londoner said. "Can't afford more." "Taken," Curry cried. "I'll go there tomorrow night." 12 o'clock is the time, mind." "Very well, then, it shall be at 12. At 12:20 the next night, James Curry entered the ravine leading to the haunted tarn. It was fine, a full moon, countless shining stars, and no clouds. He had enjoyed his walk over the moor. The air had been fresh and sweet with the scent of gorse and heather. There had been a feeling of friendliness in the atmosphere, the presence of a bond of sympathy between him and all the natural objects around him. The patches of bracken, briar, and grass, the boulders and far-off rugged mountains, all seemed to be bidding him to be of good heart. It was comforting. He felt cheerful and in excellent spirits. Everything changed the moment he crossed the threshold of the ravine, the walls of which rose high above him, their shadows darkening the stony ground. The track being so narrow, the ruts and boulders so numerous, and light so limited, he had to proceed slowly and carefully. His mood, too, underwent a change. He was no longer light-hearted, but conscious of a feeling of oppression and apprehension in the atmosphere. The gorge was no longer intensely hushed. There was occasional sounds, the falling of a fragment of rock from one of the walls of the ravine, the doleful hooting of a nightbird, the scampering over the stony ground of some small animals, and noises not quite so easy to explain. Trite as were most of them, they all made Curry start. The further he advanced, the more edged became his nerves. He blamed himself for having come, and longed to be back in the hotel, some of the inmates of which were probably sitting round the parlor fire, for the night was cold, laughing and joking, and speculating about him, whether he would win or lose the bet. As a proof that he had won, he had to bring back a pewter jug that the landlord and his son had put in a certain specified spot, close to the end of the ravine. When Curry reached the spot in the ravine beyond which he had been unable to venture, the preceding evening he experienced once again the same feeling of awful dread. Again he fancied a terrifying spirit had emerged from the tarn and was lying in wait for him round the corner of the gorge. He fought desperately to overcome the fear that chained him to the spot. He crossed himself and uttered a prayer and advanced. Foot by foot and yard by yard, he diminished very gradually the distance from the dreadful end of the rocky walls. The light from the moon and the gleam of the water grew brighter and brighter the further he progressed, and greater became the dread of what he might encounter. The end was very near now, only one or two paces more. His heart gave sickly throbs. He uttered another prayer, crossed himself again, and with a tremendous effort sprang forward so far that he almost fell into the tarn. In fearful apprehension, he glanced around him. Lying on the ground was a white figure. It was motionless. For a few moments, Curry was far too scared to look closely at the figure. When he did so, he saw to surprise and excessive indignation that it was the London Cockney wearing a white sheet. The man was seemingly unconscious. Curry sprinkled water on his face, and when he came to gave him a little of the brandy he had brought with him. When the Cockney had recovered sufficiently to sit up, he confessed, not however before Curry, who was very angry, had threatened to thrash him, that he had come there on purpose to frighten Curry and make him lose the bet. Instead of frightening Curry, he had himself, he admitted, been so badly frightened that he fainted on seeing something very dreadful come out of the tarn. Neither then nor at any time would he describe what it was he had seen. He was so shaken that Curry had to help him get back to the hotel. He left it the next day, not before, however, he had given Curry a guinea. Scottish River Hauntings. Mr. J.G. Campbell, in his book Superstitions of the Scottish Highlands, writes of hauntings of streams in Tiree, Mull, Byglastics, and other species of spirits that are apparently peculiar to Scotland. They vary as much in appearance as they do in behavior. Some are young and lovely, with blue eyes and long golden hair. Others are small, with long white hair and old and wrinkled faces. Some are mischievous and frolicsome, others beat and torment men. they are mostly clad in green. Hugh Miller, in his Scenes and Legends of the North of Scotland, also narrates hauntings by phantom green lady spirits. A Banffshire ploughman was returning home on horseback from work one autumn evening when he was accosted on the bank of a river by a tall lady in green, with her face concealed in the hood of her mantle. She asked to be taken up behind him on his horse and carried across the water. He did as she requested, and when he reached the opposite bank, she leaped lightly from the horse and removed her hood, exhibiting a pale, thin face, which seemed marked, however, by the roguish, half-humorous expression of one who had just succeeded in playing off a good joke. The ploughman was terrified to see that she was the ghost of the wife of his employer, who had been dead about 6 months. She told him to ride home quickly, and it would not be long before he saw her again. She proved as good as her word, for he often saw her. On one occasion she gave him money, which turned into pebbles, and on another occasion she pelted him with pellets of turf. She never appeared to her husband, but visited his house frequently, sometimes teasing the servants and at other times assisting them in their work. Like so many of the Scottish spirits, she seemed to be an odd mixture of a ghost and glastic, and of the physical and superphysical. In one of my books, I mentioned the haunting of the River Aughrand by a male ghost in green who terrorized the neighborhood. Many stories have been told of the haunting of a stream that flows through a glen in the north of Scotland known as Mariel's Den. One is about a youth named William Grant. He was walking by the stream in Mariel's Den one afternoon when he saw a woman in gray wearing a hood which concealed her face. She was standing quite motionless on the far side of the stream. There was something so queer about her that he stood and looked at her. Presently, she pointed to the stream in front of her. William looked and saw in the water a picture of a garden, and standing in it, a tall, pretty girl, whom he recognized as his sweetheart, Mary. She was reading a letter and smiling as if very pleased. He saw the handwriting very plainly. It was not his, and something told him that it was from a man. The scene faded away, and presently he saw Mary and a dark, good-looking young man standing at a garden gate. They appeared to be talking very earnestly. Mary threw her arms round the young man's neck and kissed him. The scene changed again, and he saw himself and Mary in a room which he recognized as the parlor of her home. They were quarreling. He was angry and seemed to be upbraiding her. She took a ring from her finger and threw it on the ground. Again the scene changed, and another rapidly succeeded it. It was in Mariel's Den. Two men faced one another. They were the dark, good-looking youth and himself. Suddenly they began to struggle, and William was horrified to see his double stab the other man. "That is all," the woman in gray said, and vanished. Everything came to pass just as it appeared to William in the river. Mary, whom he loved so much, jilted him. Mad with jealousy, he met his rival, the dark, good-looking youth, in Mariel's Den, and stabbed him. Imagining he had killed a young man, he stabbed himself and died. There is still a lingering belief in northern and western Scotland in water nixies and water kelpies, which resemble in some respects the Irish pookas, but they are perhaps rather more malignant. One story of an alleged haunting of a river in Forfarshire by a water kelpie was told me when I was staying in that county many years ago. A farm laborer was out late one night tending some cattle that were sick, when he heard a great commotion by the riverside. Hastening to see what was happening, he found his employer's horses all huddled together, snorting and stamping, and a white form, something like a horse and something like a cow, standing close to them. He picked up a stone and threw it at it. The stone encountered nothing solid, but passed through the strange figure and fell upon the ground. The laborer knew then that it was a water kelpie. It ran away laughing and leaped into the Esk, which was near the farm. While I was still in Forfarshire, I heard a legendary story about the Tay in Perthshire. On the western bank of the Tay, there was once a stone, on which the natives of the locality used to offer sacrifices to their god. One day they captured a chieftain of a neighboring tribe, stripped him, trussed him like a fowl, and laid him on his back on the stone. When they had prayed to their god, a young priestess in white robes sprinkled water from the river on his face and sharpened her large, keen-edged knife. While she was thus engaged, the chieftain cursed her and declared that if she murdered him, her spirit would be doomed to haunt forever. He had hardly finished speaking when she drew back his head and cut his throat. She dipped her hands in his blood and sprinkled the spectators nearest to her with it. That is the story, the narrator has said, and although I cannot vouch for its veracity, I have good reason to know that the spot on the bank of the Tay, where the sacrificial stone is said to have stood, is haunted. I was passing near it one night. There was moonlight. I was accompanied by my dog when the animal growled, and I saw, standing on the bank of the river, a woman in a loose, flowing white garment. She was very pale and had dark hair and eyes, and was holding in her long white fingers a glittering knife. She fascinated me. Seeing me staring at her, she frowned. Her eyes gleamed evilly, and she advanced threateningly towards me. I crossed myself and uttered a prayer, whereupon she vanished. I had to pass the spot many nights afterwards, but I never saw her again. I always felt, however, that she was never far from me, and was very thankful when I had left the riverbank well in my rear. A farmer who owned the ground on which the stone once stood told me that he had seen the apparition several times, and that always after appearance he had had bad luck. Other people testified to having heard fearful cries and dreadful moans and groans, as if someone was being horribly tortured. A Presbyterian minister held a service there one evening, and after that the haunting ceased. The curse had very possibly been lifted. Mr. William Henderson, in his Folklore of the Northern Counties of England and the Borders, refers to hauntings in the Valley of the Esk by phantom hares that are thought to be the familiar spirits of witches, and quotes the following extraordinary case. A new plantation was made in Exdale during the last century, and great havoc was done in it by hares. Many were shot, but no bullet seemed to hurt one of the most of the depredators until a silver bullet made from silver coins was used. One of these bullets struck the hare and killed it. At the moment of its death, an old woman living near the Esk, who was busy spinning wool, was seen to suddenly fling up her hands and heard to exclaim, "They have shot my familiar spirit. What am I to do?" She fell from her chair to the ground and expired. There are many stories of hauntings on both banks of the Tweed. One such story was told me by Miss Hill, a lady living near Berwick. Her father, Colonel Hill, a retired army officer, was walking along the Scottish bank of the Tweed one afternoon when he saw a man, rather strangely attired, coming towards him. Colonel Hill was buried in thought and did not notice the man very clearly until he got near him. He was then horrified to see the man lacked the head. Otherwise, apart from his clothes, which were the style worn in the latter part of the 18th century, there was nothing remarkable about the man. He walked in quite a natural manner past Colonel Hill. The colonel turned to see where he went, and he was nowhere to be seen. He had vanished quite inexplicably. When Colonel Hill related his uncanny experience to Mr. Smith, an old inhabitant of the district, Mr. Smith said, "Why, that must have been the ghost known about here as Headless Jock. He used often to be seen by the Tweed when my father was a boy, so he's cropped up again. He is supposed to be the ghost of an old miller named Jock Forbes, whose headless body was found in the Tweed sometime in the 18th century."